All right, everybody. Welcome to the Business of Art podcast. Today we are joined by Brent Cotton out of Montana. And to kind of go with the flow of what we've been doing already, I'm going to read off of a bio that he sent me and give you some background information. And then we'll let him introduce himself. So without further ado, Brent Cotton was born in 1972. He is an award-winning, nationally recognized artist living in the Bitterroot Valley of Western Montana. He prefers to paint the toneless or luminous style made popular in the late 1800s, seeking to create works that are mood-evoking and have a timeless quality. His work can be found in many private and corporate collections throughout the country. He's an avid outdoorsman, and he can often be found standing in one of the local rivers with a fly rod in his hand or on the oars of his drift boat. The close proximity to some amazing blue ribbon trout streams is one of the many reasons he and his family have made their home in the Bitterroot Valley of Montana. This passion has led Brent to focus on sporting art and particularly fly fishing as a common theme in his work. He is represented by several galleries across the country, and he participates in some of the most prestigious museum exhibitions throughout the year. Some of his most recent awards include the Wilson Hurley Landscape Award from the Prix de West show in 2018 with the National Cowboy Museum. He also won the Victor Higgins Award for the best grouping of works at the Quest of the West in 2019 at the Eilerjord Museum. He also won the Artist and Patron's Choice Award at the Night of Artists in 2020 at the Briscoe Western Art Museum. All right, Brent, sounds like you've got a pretty awesome resume here and some great reason to be on the podcast. I think that you're going to be able to help our listeners, you know, by telling and sharing your story and some of the experiences you've had, and we're just excited to have you.
Well, thanks, Mark. It's great to be on the podcast, and hopefully I won't steer anybody too wrong. You know, a lot of bad habits, I don't know. It's been an interesting journey, this crazy world of, you know, being a professional artist, but it's been a fun ride, and looking forward to many more years, hopefully, of pushing paint around on the canvas, and we'll see how it goes.
Absolutely. Well, personally, I've been a fan of your work for a long time, and I'm thrilled to talk about some of your processes and all the nitty-gritty stuff. So let's get started by talking about your journey. Please, you know, send us through the time lapse version of Brent Cotton. You know, how did you get started, you know, when you were young, what influenced you, and all the way up till now? We want to hear all the details.
The Cliff Notes version. Well, so born and raised in a wonderful ranching family in southeastern Idaho, and my grandmother was my first teacher. She was a pretty accomplished artist in her own right, very talented watercolorist, and she did landscapes in both watercolor and oil. And it was just a wonderful early part of my childhood and art career. Just basically, she would take me under her wing, not only myself, but my brothers, my cousins. It was very close to the family on the ranch there. And I mean, we would, you know, we'd draw horses, we'd draw tractors, we'd do, you know, color pencils and pastels and all the things. She would let us basically take over her giant dining room table there, you know, in grandma and grandpa's house. And we would just draw on, you know, butcher paper and that sort of thing. She's just a wonderful lady, you know, and very hardworking. You know, she's a ranch wife, so she didn't have a lot of time to devote to her art, because she had seven kids, one of them being my mom. But so it was a full life, but she was really, really talented. And she kind of helped me within the school system there. There was a gifted program for artists, and she helped me get into that. And I remember she would drive me to those classes in the evenings. And, you know, that just kind of got the ball rolling for me as you know, being very interested in art. You know, I didn't know a lot. We lived not too far from Jackson Hole, just right over the mountains, basically. So we'd go to Jackson and go through the galleries and the museums and that sort of thing. And you know, very inspirational. Again, just kind of gave me that desire to try to learn and grow and emulate what I was seeing there, you know, on the gallery and museum walls. And so those were formative years. And then my family, we ended up leaving the ranch. We moved to a little town in the middle of Kansas called Lindsborg.
Wow.
Little farming community there, settled by Swedish immigrants. And actually, it's the home of Birger Sandzane. If you're familiar with his work, he's, you know, he painted back in the late 1800s through, I think, right around World War II. I could be wrong on that, but right in that time frame. And he was a Swede, immigrated here, and they call him the Swedish Van Gogh because his paintings are so bold, they're so juicy, they're, you know, they're really amazing works. And he's had a resurgence in popularity in the last 20 years or so. You know, you see, starting to see a lot of his paintings on the auction market. Anyway, growing up in that little town, it was steeped in artistic heritage. And I had a very influential art teacher there in high school that really encouraged me, tried to foster that artistic desire that I had. And, you know, it exposed me to a whole lot of different mediums and styles of art and that sort of thing that I really hadn't been, you know, I really hadn't been exposed to prior to that. So that was a ton of fun. And he was just a great teacher, very, very influential. I don't know that, honestly, that I would have pursued a career in art had it not been for him. So I really got to give him credit. And then
that's awesome.
Yeah, it really was. And then following high school, I kind of drifted off the art path a little bit. I was still very interested in it, but I didn't really know exactly which path to take, you know. And so whether it was going to be a formal art training at a university somewhere or maybe going to illustration or something like that, I really wasn't sure. I figured that would kind of come as it did. I decided what I really wanted to do was be a hunting and a fishing guide because that was really my other passion. So I actually went to guide school in Wyoming and learned how to, you know, pack mules and shoe horses and guide hunters. And then also, you know, fly fishing was also a big passion of mine. So I, like I said, I kind of drifted off the art path, but I was still doing it on the side. I would sketch and I would paint a little bit, but and I was also doing a lot of carving. That for me, the flat work, I was okay at, but I struggled, especially with the painting. Drawing came easier. Painting, I struggled with. But my other, you know, artistic interest at the time was sculpture. And so okay. I really kind of focused on that, honestly, post high school and kind of in the off season when I wasn't doing the guiding. I was living with my parents here in Montana. We'd actually, after I graduated high school, moved to Montana. So they had settled here. And so I was living with them during the off season and actually doing bird carvings, trout carvings. I thought my claim to fame was going to be, I was going to be the best fish carver in the world. You know, and in fact, I don't know if you can see it. I don't know if you can see it. Maybe I can rotate here. This may be a little dicey. It's a little hard to see, but right there.
Above your door.
Yeah, there's a fish. That's a steelhead. That's my last wood carving that I ever did.
Well, that's awesome.
And I was probably 20 years old, I guess, when I did that. And I actually put it in a gallery in, let's see, I had a gallery in Jackson and had it in a gallery in Bozeman. Unfortunately, I didn't understand presentation very well. And the fish was mounted at kind of an angle like this and it was jumping out of the water. So I had all this plastic acrylic resin water coming off it, you know, like water drops. It was jumping out of the water. And all that resin was fragile. And every time the gallery would move it or dust it, they'd break a piece off. And consequently, the paint or the sculpture never sold. And, you know, I can understand why. People are just scared it was going to, you know, fall apart. And so I ended up keeping that as kind of a memento as my last sculpture that I did, wood carving, and it's fine. I, I don't ever want to sell the thing. So I have sculpture in my blood. It's, I feel like sculpture actually comes easier to me. I think I see and think better 3D, still to this day, even though I don't really do a lot of sculpture. I'm messing around with clay a little bit right now, but, long story short, decided the carving, I was never going to make a living at it. And, really needed to bring my painting up to a higher level. So I started taking workshops. Took some workshops in Montana. It was called the Beartooth School. It was out of Big Timber and wonderful artistic community there. Jessica Zemski and Jack Hines were the instructors, and they brought in other artists too, including some wonderful wildlife artists that I'm sure you're familiar with. Guy Koliak was one of them.
Wow.
I'm trying to think of some of the others that their names escaped me. But anyway, I took those workshops, and I was actually really focused at this time on this point in my career, wildlife and Western subjects. That was really my focus. That's really what excited me. And so those painting workshops really, I mean, they kind of opened up my eyes to not only technique and styles, but also I'm now surrounded by, you know, all these artists that are speaking the same language and excited about the same things. And I was like, wow, this is incredible. I mean, this is kind of what I've been missing, you know, because I was pretty solitary prior to this, you know, it's kind of doing my thing. And so those workshop environments were, again, they really, I feel like, propelled me to taking this career more seriously, really understanding, oh, there are people who are doing this and making a living at it, and this is how I can get there. Picking and choosing, you know, the artists who I really admire, and how can I, you know, find out if I can study with them, if, you know, and that sort of thing. So took several of those, and at one of those workshops, I actually met a lady from Oklahoma who, she was a student, but she was also a very accomplished artist in her own right, and her name is Christine Berner. And she ran an art school in Oklahoma, and she said, "Brent, why don't you come down and stay on the ranch, and I will teach you, and you know, take you under my wing, essentially." And she did, and I stayed down there for about 2 to 3 years, off and on.
Wow!
I would work on the ranch for room and board, and then I would take lessons from her. And again, it was just kind of another further opening of my mind and my eye to, you know, all this wonderful art. She had studied all around the world. She studied with Richard Schmidt and a lot of other artists, you know, beyond just the wildlife scene that I was kind of focused on. And so, and she really encouraged plein air painting and painting from life. You know, we would set up still lifes and go outdoors and paint. And that kind of, you know, under her tutelage and all of the wonderful experiences with her, is when I really started honing in and, you know, starting to find my voice. You know, that I think is for an artist, and it was for me, one of the more difficult things is to find your unique take on whatever it is. You know, it's easy to learn the skills and the technique and that sort of thing, but then taking that and making it uniquely your own. Finding your style, finding your voice, whatever, that I struggled with probably more than anything. And I think a lot of artists do. I would bounce from this artist to that artist to, you know, oh, I want to paint like this guy, or oh, I want to paint like that gal, or what, you know, I would go through little periods where, you know, I was emulating this particular artist, and then I'd move on. And I think over time, you know, I took enough information from all of those artists and then my own experimentation and growth. And eventually, you know what, my style started to emerge, but it took a while. I mean, I don't know, several years before I feel like I kind of hit upon a path that, you know, all of a sudden people were saying, oh, I can tell that's one of your paintings, Brent, you know? And
yeah,
you know, it's a great compliment. And it's, but it took a while. So fast forward after all those few years in Oklahoma, then I'm now kind of on my own, no more instruction. And I had a short little stint in Hawaii because I had a fellow artist who was living over there, and he was a struggling artist like myself. And he said, "Hey, Brent, come over, help me with the rent. I got a little condo by the beach." And I mean, who's going to turn that down, right? So I flew over there. And
no kid.
Basically, I would do these little plein air landscapes right on the beach. There was a resort area there with some of the big, you know, Four Seasons, some of these other fancy resorts. And I would go and hop on my bike, take my French easel, I'd bike down to the ocean and set up my easel and paint, you know, the sunset or the waves or palm trees or whatever, you know. And you know, they'd be small, 8x10s. And I would just sell them to the tourists that are walking by for like $50 these oil paintings. And you know, and they're wet. Like, I don't know how these people transported them home. I never really thought that far ahead. I was just happy to sell a painting for $50, you know. And
they have fingerprints all over them now.
Oh, gosh. Threw them in their luggage and they're all smeared when they got home. I don't know. But it was fun. It was fun. I remember vividly there was just a typical afternoon they're painting, and these kids were gathered around me, you know, watching. And by this time, I'm fairly comfortable painting out in front of people. My paintings were great. I mean, they were okay, but, you know, I was still learning. You know, plein air painting for me was probably the style of painting that I struggled with more than anything. It's just, you know, being out there working from life and changing light and conditions and all that. I don't think there's anything really more difficult than that. And especially if you got an audience behind you, you know, and you're like agonizing. So anyway, these kids are gathered around me, and pretty soon their mom walks up, and the mom is Maria Schwarzenegger. And these are the Schwarzenegger kids gathered around me, and finally dawned on me who they were, you know. I was waiting for Arnold to come up. And he never did. I don't know. He was off shooting a movie or something. But anyways, so that was cool. They didn't buy a painting, but I was there probably 3 years, I guess, total, off and on. I actually met my wife. She was one of the passersby on the path as I was painting. Turns out she's a girl from Montana. She was over there living and working. And yeah, we just hit it off and ended up getting married over there and then moving back to Montana. But living there on Hawaii, once I met Jenny, we got married, I actually moved up off the beach, and I moved up on the slopes of the volcano there, Haleakala. This is on Maui. And we lived there for a couple of years, and every afternoon, you know, the fog or the clouds would just settle in, and you'd just be immersed in this fog layer. This, basically, you're in a cloud. And
wow.
So as I'm doing all this landscape painting, I'm just noticing all the mood and, you know, the light and all just that veiled mystery, because it's a far different environment than down on the beach in the sun, right? So now all of a sudden my paintings, instead of bright and colorful and cheery and beachy, now they turn into this moody, misty. At the time, I'd seen tonalism and luminism and all those types of, you know, painting schools, but I really didn't think about it too much until I started painting that, you know, that moody landscape. And then I started to think, I really like this mood and this mystery that, you know, this type of lighting effect is creating. And fortunately, the paintings that I was doing, those were the ones that really took off. Like, people, it really resonated with people, that type of mood and light and drama. That's, I feel like, when I started kind of hitting my stride, is when I started honing in on a more tonal type, you know, approach. And coupled that with, I'd come over and spend summers in Montana, and, you know, as terrible as they are, those forest fires and all the smoke and everything, it also kind of reinforced all that kind of hazy, moody type of atmospheric landscape that I was really drawn to. So, you know, I was out painting in that smoky haze, not great for my lungs, I'm sure, but I was out there doing it. And I focused pretty much on plein air painting for a good number of years. I would do the occasional studio piece, but I didn't really have a studio. I was just kind of making do with it, like a little spare bedroom and that sort of thing. But so it was tight. So my preferred way of working was to just go out and paint outdoors. And it eventually we moved here to Montana in 2004. I now have a dedicated studio space and deadlines and all that sort of thing is kind of forced me to do more studio works and less plein air. I honestly probably get out and do maybe 4 or 5 plein airs a year. That's it. I don't paint plein air anymore. And I want to, I should, because I feel like, being out there and working from life, there's nothing better. You can work from photographs and I do a lot, but I feel like the knowledge that I built from those years of doing almost exclusively plein air has allowed me to now come in the studio and work from photographs and from memory or sketches. I'll do little, pen and ink sketches, or if I do a plein air, typically what it is anymore, it's not a finished piece. It's to go out there and just capture color. I'll just do color notes. I'll do like real 6x8s, and I'll just, because a lot of times, for the type of work that I do, the light is fading fast. I don't have time to do an 8x10 sometimes. So I just need to get little color notes on a canvas, couple that with some photographs and hopefully decent memory, and I can come back and I can, recreate something in a studio that hopefully reads well, and it reads as authentic, doesn't look, like it was painted from a photo, that sort of thing. Because again, I'm still focused on mood and mystery and light, and fleeting effects of light. That's really what excites me. So anyway, that's probably a so long-winded answer to whatever question it was. I don't even remember, but that's kind of where I'm at right now.
That's a really great overview of your journey. Thank you for sharing that. I always, to me, it's so valuable to hear where artists have come from and some of the background and the things the things that are inspiring you, but also informing the decisions and the choices that you're making in your work. And so that, I think that's all valuable. So, a couple of questions I had was, as you're talking about this base of plein air painting that you've created and that has been so important to your process, because that's where your education was. You spent so much time out in the field, getting those notes, those true values and colors that you would see in nature. When you're working from a photograph, what kind of things do the photographs not capture that you actually change? I'm curious to know what kind of things you're actually tweaking from a photograph versus, just a plein air, and how do you get that look like it's real and natural and airy and atmospheric, without looking like a photo?
Yeah, good question. I mean, photos are certainly, they're great. And, it's wonderful to have a camera in your pocket at all times. So, I rarely even take my nice DSLR out with me anymore. I was just using my cell phone. And quite often I'm just driving down the road and I'm just snapping photos as I'm driving. It makes my wife, drives her crazy, right? But I realize that when I'm looking at a photograph, the exposure is going to be all wonky compared to what my eye is seeing. I'm not going to be seeing all the subtleties in the shadows. The lights might be way blown out, and also just the nuance of color that, your eye can capture that a photo doesn't. Quite often the painting or the photographs that I'm using, they may be very, very bland. Like I'm just taking a photo mainly for perhaps compositional elements, things about the scene that I like, that I know that maybe my memory I'll forget. Right. So the photo for me is more of just kind of a starting point. It's a base of, okay, this, I really like this about the scene. And now I can either invent the light or I can, you know, maybe the lighting was there and it just, the photo didn't capture, but I can still recall what it was. So I can enhance that. I can punch the color up. I can, you know, add more, air and, you know, interest into the shadow areas that maybe are just, you know, black essentially in the photograph. You know, it's been a journey of learning how to do that, do it convincingly. And I still feel like, you know, a lot of days I'm winging it, man. I'm just trying to make something pleasing to my eye and hopefully it resonates with the viewer. And this will probably lead to other, you know, questions is, you know, how do you keep your art interesting and exciting and, you know, how do you as the artist maintain a level of enthusiasm for your work? That's a challenge in and of itself, but hopefully that answered your question about photos. You know, I realize that a photograph, again, is just, it's a jumping off point. It's not the be all end all. Now, granted, some photos I can take and I can look at that photo and go, wow, that, like, I don't need to do anything to that. That's awesome. And I can try to recreate it, but I don't like just recreating a photo. I want to put my input into it. So I'm always moving things around, you know, again, changing up the light or the mood, depending on what I want to say with that particular piece. So, but yeah, it's a combination of memory, sketches, photos, and pure invention. That's kind of how I create my pieces.
That's really cool.
Like I could point to this painting on the easel, for example. I don't know how well it shows up on the screen there, but
I think it's showing pretty good. Yeah, let's talk about it.
Okay, so this is the Bitterroot River. So this is just a few miles from my house. And so the photograph was, I mean, the scene looked like this, minus the campfire, minus the figures. You know, that's all pure invention. That's, you know, purely out of my head. You know, I spend a lot of time on the river. I, you know, whether I'm fishing or camping or whatever. And so hanging out with my buddies or my family and building a campfire and, you know, reminiscing about the day. Those are memories and activities that really inspire me as an artist. I want to recreate those moments. So this painting basically is saying, you know, this is three guys out enjoying a nice day on the river, or maybe not such a nice day if you look at them. It's kind of cold and nasty, but at least they got a nice warm fire to huddle up next to you. But this one, you know, the photograph, I could probably pull up the photo and show you what it looks like. And you could see that how I've varied it. There might be something interesting to do. Maybe I could send that photograph to you and you could post it, superimpose it, or somehow it might give the viewers kind of an idea of how I take my photograph and how I change it or, you know, add the mood or whatever.
Yeah, I'll definitely have that attached to the bottom of the podcast. So
yeah, I think that's valuable, you know, because I mean, so many of my paintings, you know, that if you were to look at the reference for that painting, you'd be like, how the heck did you end up with that result from that reference? It doesn't compute, you know? So, but that's, again, I guess that's a whole part of the process, right? Is, you know, sometimes I feel like I've got a pretty clear vision of where I want to go with that painting and I can meet it. Other times the vision, the end result is a little nebulous. It's a little like fuzzy. I don't really know where I'm going with this painting. And I'm almost kind of letting the painting kind of direct me along. And that can be really fun. It can be terrifying too. You know, because you're kind of like a ship without a rudder. You're kind of, you know, it can take you in a really bad direction too. So that's a risk. And that, I think that kind of keeps the process fun. Because I know that there's an element of uncertainty with where I'm heading. I don't know. It's just me. Like I said, I'm winging it, man.
Yeah, no, I think that's really valuable because I think a lot of times a lot of artists will they'll get some kind of reference and it'll put them in a box, you know, and mentally at least, and they feel like they can't, you know, break away from it or expound on it or change or tweak anything. And I think, you know, that was something for me early on that I had to figure out was, you know, like just because it's in the photo doesn't mean I should paint it. And so I really like hearing that, you know, a photograph it's a starting point, you know, or even just a resource that's giving you some information that you need, to make it more believable or whatever that is. But when you can kind of go off and veer off in your own direction and the ship without a rudder, you know, I think that's when some of the neatest things happen. And sometimes it's a flop. But I think the fact though that you have that freedom to fail, you know, and the nice thing is that it's not a failure until, you know, you like throw the painting in the garbage and burn it or something, you know.
Right.
You can scrape the paint off and rework it. You know, it's not over till it's over. And so I think that's a valuable thing to talk about with the audience.
It is. I mean, I feel like it's pretty easy as an artist, you know, once you've kind of hit upon a style or whatever, it's easy to kind of just stay in that same rut. And I always say rut, that's probably too strong of a word, but you stay in your comfort path, right? And that's what you want to stay in. And it's hard to deviate from that. But yet at the same time, I think it's healthy for an artist to try to push yourself and grow. And growth is going to come with some of those failures. That's just part of life, man. And art is no different. I think some of my most successful paintings have been the ones that, wow, it was a battle. And I wasn't sure I was going to succeed on the other side. And you know, truly, I mean, I have thrown paintings in the garbage and my wife has dug them out. And said, you're not going to throw that away. You're going to, you know, attempt to fix this. And so I'm maturing as an artist. What I typically do if I'm really struggling with a piece, and I'm not the type of artist that can look at it and analyze it, you know, with such a, you know, wonderful artistic cerebral intelligent approach. I'm more instinctual. So I'll look at it and go, man, I really have no clue what's bothering me about this piece. I can't really figure it out. I'll have my wife come in. She's got a great eye. She can look at it. And a lot of times she'll be able to say exactly what's maybe bothering her. But what I found pretty valuable is just take that painting, turn it around, lean it up against the wall. Don't even look at it for several weeks or whatever. And then flip it around, and usually I can pick something about it that maybe I hadn't seen because I had tunnel vision, you know, when I was working on it before. But, you know, I think that don't be afraid to fail. You know, don't be afraid to experiment. I'm always trying, you know, new subject matter. I mean, that in and of itself is going to really push you and challenge you. So, you know, I'm trying that. And I think as you grow, your skill set grows, you're going to naturally want to try some things that maybe you've been hesitant to try before.
Yeah.
You know, like it's for me and portraits. Portraits are not my thing, but I do them and I'm wanting to get better. So, you know, and same thing with wildlife. So now wildlife, again, was kind of my first love. And then I moved away and moved kind of strictly into landscapes. Now I'm wanting to do more wildlife again. So, you know, for me, it's been a bit of a challenge. I got to get my skills, you know, back up to that level. Try to, you know, see what you're doing is so inspiring. I want to try to see if I can, you know, get back into that, you know, level of skill again, with that subject. And so, I think it's just healthy as an artist to do that. You really need to. If for whatever reason I'm just not feeling in the painting mood, man, there's no better recharge for me than to just get outdoors. Just get out, you know, go fly fishing. I'm an avid hunter too. I like to get out. I get some of my best ideas, you know, when I'm sitting in a tree stand or I'm, you know, hunting elk or whatever, you know, I want to be out there immersed in that. And I feel like I need that again to add that authenticity to my work, and also recharge the creative battery. You know, you need to do that. It's hard to be stuck in the studio for months at a time as you're preparing for a show or whatever. And man, after that's over, I don't even want to step in my studio for weeks. I just want to get out and recharge, you know. I'll lock the studio door behind me, and you know, I can't do that, obviously, realistically. But there are periods of time where I will take a few weeks off and go get jazzed again. You have to.
That's awesome. You know, it's interesting, as I've been interviewing some other artists, I feel like this is an ongoing theme, that where artists, it's really valuable for them to connect with nature. You know, we're so stuck in our studios, and we're spending so much time kind of isolated and just cranking at the easel.
Yeah.
And it's so important that we get out, and you know, it's, you know, you obviously do landscapes, and you're painting the natural world. You know, I do wildlife, and others do wildlife or animals or, you know, whatever that is, but it's outside, it's in nature. And, yeah, and it makes total sense that, you know, getting out in nature is going to make a big difference as far as, you know, keeping that drive alive and the excitement and the passion and just even a good recharge. You know, it's easy to just get so sucked in and locked into that work. But if you don't take the time, even if it's just an hour, and get out and just go take a drive or see something pretty.
Yeah.
You know, I see that for me is really beneficial. So
it is. And I just in the last year, to recharge, and it's a totally different subject matter for me, but I've been really getting into golf. And so now I'm out on these golf courses. I'm taking photos, you know, I'm like, oh man, I'm going to start my new phase of my career. Brent Cotton, golf course painter. You know? No, I probably won't. But that's, speaking of getting outdoors and just getting a recharge, like I'll go play 9 holes of golf, you know, a couple times a week. And now all of a sudden I'm, you know, I've had my outdoor, you know, experience, and, you know, now I'm jazzed to get back in the studio. And I've yet to start a golf course painting, but you know, don't be surprised if you see one at some point in time.
Yeah, we'll be looking for it for sure.
some guy standing by himself, fire on one of the greens or something. I don't know.
That's a great idea.
Yeah,
and then you've got a golf cart in the background, and they're a golf cart with some siren lights on it. They're going to come and take him out.
That's right. Yeah. I like it. It's a whole new genre, baby.
Yeah, right. No, right.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I was kind of wanting to shift gears a little bit, because I, you know, you talked a little bit about when you were in Hawaii and you'd sell the art when people would just come and see it, by those resorts. What are the avenues that you are pushing to sell your work? How are you marketing yourself? How are you getting your work in front of the right kind of audience that can purchase it?
Well, that's a whole new kind of a conversation of my progression as just a wet behind the ears. Like when I was saying about the wood carving that I did, and I took it to a couple of galleries, and you know, I would just cold call. I just walk in. I had no phone call ahead of time, no letter, no nothing. I mean, this is pre-email, and you really, I mean, the internet was kind of in its infancy. So there really was no way to market your work that I was aware of, apart from getting in the galleries or maybe running a magazine ad or something like that. And I didn't have the money to run magazine ads. So yeah, I was doing these carvings, and I just basically just walked into these galleries carrying these pieces under my arm and said, hey, do you want to show my work? And initially that opened doors, and they were showing my carvings. And then as I started doing paintings, now all of a sudden, you know, this is, you know, a few years later, now all of a sudden websites were a thing and artists were having their own websites and that sort of thing. So I, you know, I did a kind of a rudimentary website, but I was still mainly showing my work through galleries. That was, you know, that was the main avenue to, you know, expose my work to the public was the galleries. And I've had some great galleries over the years. I've had some lousy ones too, you know. It's, and I think every artist maybe is kind of got that story, you know, of the turbulent gallery world. But So years and years of just basically doing the gallery thing, you know, occasional national shows like Oil Painters of America. There was a show back in the early 2000s called the Arts for the Parks. And I entered that contest and I won one of the awards there that year that I entered. And that kind of opened doors more than anything, probably because that particular painting, it got the attention of Trailside Galleries in Jackson Hole. Okay. They said, "Hey, we saw your work in Arts for the Parks. Would you like to be represented by us?" And I said, "Absolutely." So I started showing my paintings with them. Now, when I walked in there, I don't think the owner, Mary Vaughn, realized it, but 5 years earlier, I'd walked in there carrying that big fish carving and she turned me down. Now here I am 5 years later, but I'm walking in with a body of paintings, right? And now she's like,
"Oh, yeah,"
but she had no recollection of me being the young kid carrying in this fish sculpture. But anyway, had a great run with Trailside, you know. And so, yeah, man, marketing work. It's far easier now as an artist getting into it, I think, with social media and just being able the reach that you can have as an artist prior, you know, as opposed to when I was starting out where the galleries had the reach, you as the artist really didn't, you know. Eventually, yes, more and more websites and more, you know, people could find you that way. But nowadays I just feel like, the marketing is easier, but now I'm wondering if you kind of get lost in the crowd, you know, that there's almost too much. And how can you set yourself apart there? I feel fortunate that, you know, I'm on a trajectory, at least from this point in my career, where, you know, I'm in a lot of the major museum shows. So that gets great exposure for my work. I still have a few galleries. I don't do as much work with galleries anymore. I just don't have the time, and you know, they're not very happy with me, but I can only produce so much work, you know, good work. I mean, I could produce more work, but it wouldn't be as good. And, it would pull away from my family time and all the other priorities in my life. So, and I think that's another thing that artists have to be concerned about is piling too much on your plate. And I've been guilty of that. I've been guilty of not really managing my time as well or being as disciplined as I could be, you know, and I maybe take on too much and then I'm stressed and then I'm maybe not doing my best work, you know, and that sort of thing. So I would caution artists to not load the plate up too full. And, you know, I feel very blessed and fortunate that I do have a lot of demands on my work and I do have great exposure for it now. But I mean, I love Instagram, you know. I'll post paintings on there. Some of them little paintings out of my studio, and shoot, man, I'll get people from overseas. "Hey, I want to buy that painting," you know, and you know, it's been amazing. Like, how else could you market your work to folks from, you know, wherever? I mean, it's, you know, paintings going to Dubai or, you know, United Kingdom or some, you know, it's wild. The reach that you have nowadays. So,
yeah.
Anyway, that's kind of my journey.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I like to ask this question too, because, you know, with the shift in times, you know, you said it was really heavy in the gallery scene early on because you didn't have social media. We didn't have all these avenues. But now I think that the biggest challenge, like you said, is like there's now that there's so much capacity to share your work with the masses, it's easy to get lost in the crowd. And so if you had to start over, and this is hypothetical.
Starting right now?
Yeah. Yeah. If you had to start over right now, what do you think your approach would be?
Well, that is a very good question. I mean, I think that obviously I would take advantage of, you know, all the social media that's out there. I'd be much more proactive in that. I mean, like I said, I do Instagram, I do Facebook. I've never done YouTube, although I get people saying, "Hey, you should have your own channel and do all this stuff." I just can't manage all of that. That's like trying to juggle too many balls, man. I just want to focus on the work. If I had somebody that could do all that for me, then maybe I would, you know, really focus on it. But I'm not sure I would do things too much differently. I mean, again, I think the main thing is I want to be true to myself. I want to do what I love, and hopefully the work that I'm doing resonates with people. And so if I can do that, and if it can, you know, hopefully separate myself from the crowd, so that in this, you know, this big world of, you know, the digital age, if somehow I can still stand out, that's what I would focus on doing. You know, it's very easy, I think, to chase trends and say, oh, this is what people are buying right now. I'm going to just, you know, go for that. And I see a lot of artists trying to do that. And I don't know. I think that I can understand kind of why they want to do that, but I do feel like, you know, at some point you're going to burn out, or, you know, you're just going to be kind of known as an artist who chases whatever the latest thing is that, you know, is the hot ticket. I don't want to do that. I want to paint my time on earth. I want to paint my lived experience. I want to paint what I know. It's a record. It's a record basically of, you know, my life here. But I want to do that in a way that hopefully just captivates people. It provides an escape. Like I've had some great compliments over the years, and it really makes me feel good. You know, when people come up and say, oh, you know, your paintings, they touch me emotionally. Like it brings up memories, and, you know, maybe that's my dad out there or my brother, or, it's captivating, but it also provides solace. It provides, you know, something to, you know, again, kind of escape into after a hard day's work. You come home and you look at the art and it feeds your soul. That, you know, for me, there's no greater compliment, as an artist, to have that kind of feedback on my work. And, you know, for a lot of years, I never had that feedback because the work is being sold through galleries. I never had the interaction with the collectors one-on-one, or very rare.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I have much more ability, whether it's, you know, email, digital, social media, whatever, or just in going to the shows and interacting with the patrons. Which I really, really enjoy. I love to get that, you know, the feedback and what they're feeling about the works. And it's really gratifying. So,
As far as getting into some of these shows, you said you're in some of the best, you know, museum shows and things like that that are across the country. What's that process been like for you to get into those, and you know, what does that look like for somebody?
Well, speaking for myself, I think mine's been a little bit unique. The Prix de West, which was kind of go back in time to when I was studying in Oklahoma with Christine, she took me to the Prix de West in Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
I'd never been there. I didn't even know what the Prix de West was. And maybe some of your viewers don't know what the Prix de West is, but it's the longest running Western art show, invitational art show. Most prestigious, I would say. I mean, there's a lot of great museum shows out there, but they were kind of the first, and still, for me, that's the pinnacle. And so when I went there with Christine and I saw, you know, the amazing venue, I saw the incredible work, I set it as a goal. I said, hey, I want to be in this show, you know, at some point in my life. And yeah. I got the call. They actually invited me, as opposed to submitting, which is the normal process, I think, for a lot of the artists you actually submit. But I think they do. I think they do reach out to a fair amount of artists, too. But I think a lot of it is submitting. But anyway, I got a phone call and they said, hey, you're in the Prix de West. And I mean, I was like, this was 15 years after I'd gone there with her. Wow. So it took me a while, you know, but I mean, that was like getting called up to the majors, man. I was like, wow, I mean, I made it, I guess. I don't know, you know, but now the pressure's on because now you gotta produce and that's a high bar. And you don't want your work to suffer by comparison on the wall. And so, man, I mean, I was agonizing that first year I went to the pre. I was like, I mean, I could take two paintings, and I remember I had probably a half a dozen laid out and tried to pick the two best, you know, and it ended up being a wonderful experience. I sold both of them my first year, and I was just on a high. So the pre for me has been an amazing show. I just shipped them out yesterday. As a matter of fact, I just shipped out my paintings. So it's always fun to see them hanging on the wall. And then the other shows, so I do the Briscoe. I do, I do the Masters of the American West at the Autry Museum. I do the Briscoe show and the Idle Jord Quest for the West. Although I'm not doing that one this year, I took that one off the schedule. I just couldn't do enough. I mean, couldn't produce enough. So, and all of those have been invitation for me. So that's very rewarding and humbling, you know, to get that invitation. But I would say, you know, if you're an artist that is working in this Western genre, those events, man, even if you're not in the show, you should make it a point to go to the show and just see what it entails, the atmosphere, the excitement. You'll be inspired, obviously, by the quality of the work. And it's an amazing experience. I know you're in the Briscoe, and what other shows are you in, those museum shows?
Yeah, so the Briscoe, we've got like the Museum of Wildlife Art in Jackson.
Oh, sure, yeah. Western Vision. That's a great one, yeah.
The Buffalo Bill.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. It's just a hop, skip, and a jump for me.
Yeah. There's so many out there, you know.
Yeah. There's quite a few. It's interesting. You know, my personal experience was like the Buffalo Bill, for example, I was actually the high school art teacher in Cody.
I didn't know that. That's awesome. Yeah,
the museum across the street.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. And anyway, they do a little scholarship program there, and I got that when I was, you know, first kind of moved into the area. I won their little scholarship, and then I started applying, and it took me 8 years to get into that show, applying year after year. Uh-huh. But I think it was an interesting situation because, you know, I was just a local, you know, high school art teacher for the longest time in their eyes. And so I just didn't equate. And it was after I got into the Briscoe in Texas that I actually got accepted into the the
Buffalo that's Bill. Interesting. Well, you know that, I think that's, I'm not surprised by that because I think that, you know, all the shows kind of pay attention to who's showing where. Yeah. And once you kind of get your foot in the door in one, then you start to get the notice of the others. And it can be a really good stepping stone just to get into one of those, you know, because now all of a sudden the exposure level is heightened. And I would certainly encourage artists to enter as many competitions, apply for shows, you know, just don't be hesitant. I think if I had advice to myself going back in time, I think that there were years where I was just too hesitant. Like I didn't feel my work was good enough. And, you know, I was very self-critical. And I know that, I mean, looking back, my work really wasn't good enough. So I was right in thinking that. But I think if I could have stepped out a little bit and been afraid to, or not been afraid to face a little bit more rejection, I had to develop a little thicker skin. I had galleries reject me early on. I can remember when I first lived on Maui, I put together a portfolio, you know, an actual, like, you know, flipping the pages kind of portfolio. This is pre-internet, no website, no nothing. So, and I took this, I took a lot of pride in this portfolio I put together, you know, and I took it over to some galleries in Lahaina and walked in the door. I actually made a phone call this time. I actually set them an appointment. So I was learning, but they turned me down. They said, you're okay, but you're not quite what we're looking for. You know, that was a kind of a big kick in the gut. Like, oh man. Yeah. And then to top it all off, I come outside, put my portfolio on my truck as I'm loading some other stuff, and I drive off and forget the portfolio. It falls off and I never did find it.
Oh no.
So somebody on Maui's got a portfolio somewhere, but and sad thing is the gallery that I walked in and rejected me, that burned down this past year.
I was gonna say, so I know that there was that big fire in Lahaina. That's what a devastation.
Yeah, it was horrific. And we had just been over there back in March of last year and spent a little bit of time in Lahaina and all of that. But so that was kind of my gallery experience there in Lahaina. And then I moved over to another part of the island called Hana. It's completely in the other side of the island. And that was just a kind of a small little village. And really, there was not much there except for this resort. And I started showing in that gallery there in the resort. And that started getting the ball rolling for me. But I was afraid to approach that gallery for a long time because they had a really stellar reputation. And, you know, after getting kicked out of Lahaina's, I just felt like, man, my work is just not good enough for Hana. And so it took me probably a year before I felt confident enough to go over there and got in the door. So really applied myself, really worked hard to try to get better. And again, try to establish a more unique style as opposed to just trying to copy someone else.
Yeah. You know, from my personal experience, you know, there's definitely been a lot of, you know, kind of rubber on the road, and where you're just, you know, you're knocking doors, not literally, but like you're getting yourself out there.
And, sure.
And, you know, those rejections hurt, you know, every time it's a sucker punch to the gut, and
it really does.
And you kind of run away with your tail between your legs, and it takes a while to kind of recoup from that. But it's so important that you don't end on that. You know, if I were to go back and just, you know, throw in the towel, and like, it's crazy how much good comes when we have those experiences and we learn from them, and it pushes us to grow and to become better. And I think that, you know, any kind of an artist who really wants to make this a profession is going to have to, you know, develop that thick skin and not take everything personally. I think sometimes when you get rejected from a gallery, it's not because your work isn't the quality. It actually is because it's just like they've already got other artists that have worked maybe similar or in the same genre. And they're not looking for a landscape artist or a wildlife guy.
Yeah, it makes total sense.
It's hard to know. Yeah. So no, that's valuable. You know, keep going. You know, I guess one other thing I want to ask is, you know, a lot of the people who are listening, I'm assuming are beginners. They're just getting started. They're just getting their feet wet. And they're probably facing challenges like this. You know, maybe they've gotten rejected by a gallery. You know, if you could go back to you or to them early on, what are some things, like what some pieces of advice that you would, like, how would you coach yourself and prepare, help yourself to be more prepared for some of those challenges?
I think what I would do is, I would visit as many, you know, galleries in my area or wherever as I could. And just what you're talking about, where you walk in and you go, oh, you know what? They already have a wonderful wildlife artist in here. They're probably not going to be the artist, you know, I'm probably not going to be the artist they're interested in. But, you know, it doesn't hurt to ask them. But I would try to find a gallery that you feel like might be the best fit first. And maybe they're not the most prestigious name or the one with the most cachet, but that's okay. You know, I think for a lot of my early career, I thought, well, if I'm not in such and such gallery, then I'm never going to make it, you know? And so I would maybe avoid some of these other smaller galleries, even though maybe I liked the personnel really well and I liked the work that they had. I just didn't feel like maybe they were, I don't know, right for me. And I've had regrets over doing that. And I've ultimately, in a couple of occasions, decided that was completely bass-ack we're taking. And I go, you know, I pull out of this major gallery where I just decide not to pursue them. And I go and I try the smaller gallery. And man, you know, things go great. So, you know, I would definitely see where you fit or you feel like your work fits best. And, you know, get a good feeling for the personnel. I always encourage an artist to talk to some of the artists that that gallery represents and see how they do business, you know, or is it a good relationship? Do they market you well? Do they pay well? How do they, you know, what's their customer interaction, you know? Because it's, you know, the gallery is kind of a reflection upon you too, as you're hanging on their walls, you know?
Yeah.
So that's important. So I would always encourage artists to do kind of a little bit of legwork and homework on the various galleries that they're thinking about. You know, I don't know what to say more than that. It's just, again, don't try to just chase trends. You know, if you see, wow, that particular artist is hot and there's several others that are kind of mimicking and they're also doing great, maybe I should just jump on that. Man, I don't know. It's a very enticing thing to do, but I feel like it can kind of be a dead end road, you know, and it's not saying that artists can't be very, very successful doing that. And there are artists who, man, they hit the ground running. It's like they just explode on the scene and, you know, and something unique and different and that's exciting. And I love to see it. But you know, it's not the norm. It just doesn't happen typically. Yeah, I mean, it's go ahead.
Yeah, from my perspective, you know, chasing a trend is, to me, it's just not going to feel authentic. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's specific things that I love to paint, and it's because I'm just naturally inclined to really enjoy the subject matter and the way that I'm approaching it. And so for me, if I'm doing something because it's like, well, I'm painting this mainly because I think it's going to sell and it's kind of the trend right now. Yeah. I'm not going to be as invested in that emotionally to make it a great painting. And I honestly can say there's been some paintings when I'm like, you know what? I need to sell. And I didn't love the subject, but I thought, yeah, what? I think it'll sell. And the painting suffered, you know, and there's been two or three pieces that I've thrown away or I've burned or, you know, break them in half.
Or you sold them, but you want to get them back because you don't want them
right
on the market.
Right. Yeah. Oh yeah. You regret it. And it's out there advertising your name and your reputation on somebody's wall. And yeah, you just got to be careful, to just make sure you're doing something that is important to you. And yeah, like there's always the caveat, you know, I have a family, you have a family, you gotta sell paintings. You know, we gotta survive.
Exactly.
But it's a hard balance to figure out, I think. You know, how have you found that balance personally?
Well, I totally agree with you. You know, I've had to take on projects that I'm not excited about because I needed to pay the bills, you know, and I still occasionally will do that because it's maybe just too good of an opportunity to pass up, even though artistically I may not be as excited about it. And I, like you, never feel like I do my best work on those types of projects. I can get into it. I can, especially if the client is very open to, you know, my artistic interpretation. And typically I won't take a commission project on unless they allow me a lot of latitude there, because I explain to them, I'm like, hey, you're going to get a better painting if you let me, you know, just kind of have creative expression and I'll take, you know, some input from you on kind of what you're wanting, but then turn me loose and you'll have a better piece. And most clients are very receptive to that. But yeah, juggling that, yeah, artistic integrity, wanting to do what you want to do, pursuing your passion and all that, and balancing that with reality of life, and you've got to pay the bills. It can be challenging. There's just no question about it. You know, I'm not independently wealthy. I still have to sell paintings. But I try to again, produce work that if I feel like I'm putting my best out there, because I'm passionate about it, I feel like I'm going to find an audience. Sometimes it takes a while. You know, there's paintings that I've loved that have sat in galleries for years. There's paintings that I'm not too crazy about and they sell quick, you know, so you never know. I've given up trying to predict what's going to resonate. I just know that I feel like, again, if I do my best, and I realize I'm human, I'm not going to hit a home run. Not every painting is going to be a masterpiece. But if I can strive for quality and not settle for just knocking them out, pumping them out to meet demands, then I feel like I can sleep at night as an artist. I'd be like, yeah, you know, I let that thing go out the door and I'm relatively pleased. Again, you're probably like this too. I'm a really hard critic on myself. I never am like, wow, that's a amazing painting. You know, I'm always like, well, I could probably done that better. Or maybe I could, you know, because I'm always pushing and trying to grow. So,
yeah.
I don't know. It's not an easy thing to balance it, but, I feel like I'm managing it better. I think that, not loading my plate again too full to where I'm forced to having to push out work that really isn't my best stuff. I feel like I've got the luxury of being at this point in my career where, you know, I can sit on some paintings if they're not that great, or I can,
yeah,
you know, I don't have to produce as much work to make a living. I've got enough higher price point for my work now that I don't have to produce as much work. And that's a really good feeling to have. I've got young kids and, you know, I don't want to be stuck in the studio all the time. I want to be out enjoying Montana and you know, building memories and experiences with my kids and my friends. So it's all a balance. Like I said, I'm winging it. I feel some days I'm doing better than others, but, I can't imagine doing anything else. And I mean, quite honestly, I'm not qualified to do anything else. So I got to make this art thing work. I'm not going to be a professional golfer anytime soon or professional fly fisherman. So, you know, I still have to, you know, produce quality work, appealing work people, you know, want to part with their hard-earned money for. So, but I feel very, very blessed. You know, I just think, you know, I'm a Christian man and I just feel God has blessed me richly. And I just want to continue to show the glory that I see out there. You know, there's so much beauty in the world. You know, you read the news and everything and you kind of focus on some of the not so pretty, some of the ugliness in the world. But I want to produce stuff that, again, is uplifting, spiritual, you know, pieces that people can find solace in that. And I think that as long as I do that, I'm going to find, you know, favor with the collectors. So that's my spiel. Awesome.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. And, you know, the journey is hard and, but you know, there's a lot of ups and downs and from my experience, you know, that things always work out. You know, I think that a lot of being an artist is faith. It's putting yourself out there with a lot of uncertainty, you know, like there's no guarantee of a paycheck at the end of this, the end of this painting or whatever it is, you know, getting ready for a show and, you know, living by that is a challenge for sure. But it's been incredible for me to see how often, you know, even though things get pretty tight, you know, or, you know, maybe the savings gets really thin, a painting will always sell, you know, and I'll be able to keep the lights on in the studio and supplies,
right.
Supplies handy. And I can make more art. And, you know, I don't think it's the life for everybody, especially if you don't have, you know, that the ability to handle those ups and downs, but man, you know, I think living, living in that uncertainty, but just kind of trusting that things will play out well. They do, you know, it's powerful stuff.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, it is a roller coaster ride profession. It's not for the faint of heart, man. I mean, it's feast or famine sometimes. And man, you just take the blessings when they come, and you hope you save enough for a rainy day. And it's a luxury. It's a luxury item. It's not necessary in people's lives, you know, for day-to-day living, but I think it is necessary. Art is necessary for your spirit, and I think it feeds the soul. And I mean, for me, I'll come out to the studio, and maybe, you know, there's stuff going on in the rest of my life, maybe that's a little topsy-turvy or whatever. And man, I'm just having kind of a down day. I'm not really excited about painting. But I can get back into it. You know, I play classical guitar badly, but I play it. I'll pick that up and I'll play a little bit, and you know, it'll start to get my frame of mind in a different, you know, space. And I will now be excited to pick up that paintbrush. And I guess what I'm trying to say is I haven't lost the joy yet for creating art, and I hope I never do. But you got to do stuff to kind of keep that joy alive, and you got to keep feeding that soul, and you got to, and I find it going to shows and being inspired by my peers. You know, I mean, I can look at one of your paintings and just be absorbed in the amazing brushwork and the mood and the light that you have in your pieces. And that'll get me excited to come back and, you know, get to my own paintings. And so I think that, you know, we're so fortunate that we get to produce something that hopefully will be around for a long, long time. You know, gives the viewer again, a taste of some beauty and art. As the artist, it gives them our passion for the subject. And it's, I don't know. I think that, again, so fortunate to be able to do this. And honestly, I wouldn't be, you know, unhappy if I died with a palette knife or a paintbrush in my hand. You know, that would be nice. I'd be a happy man. Yeah. 8 till I'm 95, you know?
Yeah, I hope so too. I hope I've got more than, I'm turning 40 this year, so I hope I've got another 40 to really work at this.
You're just a youngster, man. I'll be 52 in a few weeks, so it doesn't feel that way. But we're blessed individuals, that's for sure. So
yeah,
did you want to ask about my palette or any of my tools?
Yeah, if you want to go into that, I would love to hear about your palette and some of the tools you use.
Well, so my palette, I don't know if you can see it very well. Maybe I can zoom in a little bit there. Possibly, I don't know. Might not be worth doing, but
I think we're okay. Yeah,
it's a fairly limited palette. It's basically. And you can see the buildup of paint here. I'm not sure if you can, but that's like 10 years, 15 years worth of buildup of white. You know, I just squeeze fresh paint on top. I call it my stalagmites, my little paint stalagmites. It's building and building. At some point, I think I'm going to retire this palette, and I'll probably paint a scene on it, you know, a landscape or something.
Yeah.
I'll mount it, you know, so you can hang it on the wall. It'll have all these dried paint piles, but... Anyway, it's pretty limited. It's just titanium white, cad yellow light, raw sienna, cad orange, cad red light, probably my favorite color, transoxide brown, permanent magenta, ultramarine blue, and viridian. And occasionally I'll put a thalo green or something if I'm feeling really adventurous. But
okay.
That's pretty much the palette. You know, sometimes I don't have the bright cadmiums on. I'll just kind of stick with the earth tones. It really depends on the subject, but that's kind of my overall palette selection. And I would stick with that for landscapes or portraiture or still lifes or whatever. It kind of runs the gamut. I feel like I can cover most of the bases. Occasionally there's a color I can't mix with that palette, you know, like a bright fuchsia or something like that if I'm painting florals or whatever.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I think I can get what I need to get with that selection.
So as far as paint application goes, yeah, what I'm assuming that you use brushes, but I know you use the palette knife. So what's that like?
Well, so my favorite brushes are these guys right here. Cheap hardware store brushes, you know, just big, you know, things that I can cover the canvas or the board quickly with. But I'll paint with these too. I like them. You know, I have a whole arsenal of nice brushes, but I rarely use them. I'll use the, you know, some of these smaller ones. I like, you know, these kind of badger hair flats. I like those a lot.
Okay.
Nice. And then just my small, you know, liner brush, some of the details. That's about it for brushes. And then my two palette knives. And I mean, I'll do 90% of a painting with this thing right here. Occasionally, wow, I'll use the littler guy.
Yeah.
So after I've used my, you know, my big brush to block in the painting, get the major shapes established, then I'll go in and just typically do all the refining, the drawing, you know, all of this with just this knife.
Wow.
I really feel like to get the effects that I want, I'm much more comfortable using a knife now than I am a brush. And that's not real recent that I've been doing that, but it's I would say it's been within the last 10 years that I've really kind of transitioned over more into a palette knife application. And I just really like the way the paint comes off the knife. And I use a knife a little different manner than a lot of palette knife painters that you see out there that apply the paint really thick and impasto.
Yeah,
I will do that, but a lot of my paint application is thinner. So like I will, after I've used that big brush to kind of establish a mass, then typically what I do is I will block it in kind of a mid-tone value, all the masses.
Yeah.
And then I'll come back in and maybe I'll let that mid-tone layer dry. And I use Liquin. I've got Liquin on my palette. I don't use it because I love it. I really actually do not like Liquin, but it works because it, you know, dries quickly.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a necessary evil. I'm not a huge fan, but I haven't really found anything to work better. But I like to let that initial block in kind of dry. And then what I'll do typically is I'll come back in and maybe I'll use a smaller brush and just establish some darks, because I want my darks to be pretty thin. I rarely will apply my darks with a palette knife. I will almost always put the darks in with a brush just because I want a thinner application. Sometimes it'll be more of a glaze. The darks will be more of a glaze, and I'll just kind of wipe them, maybe paper towel, whatever, to kind of make sure they're not on there too thickly, whatever. And then I'll come back in with my knife and you know, a thicker application of paint. Then I will typically drag in the lights. I'll bring the lights in with the knife because I want my lights to be thicker than my darks. I want my darks thin, my lights thick. You know, you get that interplay of thick and thin. Yeah. I just think it's more interesting visually when you study the painting to see that kind of, you know, varying texture. As opposed to being kind of all uniformly just impasto, I like to have, you know, areas that are, you know, just varied. So, but yeah, most of the lights, all of that is done with a knife. And then if I've got small details, you know, like say, for example, the figures and that sort of thing, that's where I'll go in with a smaller brush. Occasionally I can do those with a knife, but even a small knife gets a little unwieldy when you're trying to do, you know, small details. So, typically transition to a smaller knife to do some of that stuff. But I'll hang on to the knife as long as I can throughout the painting before I put it down and, you know, pick up the small brushes. But yeah, it's fun. And I will paint on, I paint mainly on gator board. And now sometimes the gator board is just primed with a gesso And I'll get, again, I use these big brushes to get just kind of random texture, because I don't like a slick surface. I like something with some tooth.
Yeah.
So if I'm painting on just that primed board with that kind of underlying gesso texture, and in combination with the knife, I can get some really cool effects. You know, you get some of those happy accidents, like Bob Ross used to say. You get some of that stuff happening that isn't really planned. Some of it can be planned, and I will do a limited amount of planning, but most of the time it's just like, go with it. And most of the time it works. Sometimes you're kind of fighting the texture and you got to scrape it down or sand it down a little bit. So a prime gator board is kind of what I've been using most recently. The other thing that I will do is I will take that same gator board, but I will glue linen to it. So I'm working on a nice linen, and I like the linen texture too. Anymore though, I'm kind of enjoying more of the, just the primed board with the random texture. I kind of am gravitating to that, but working on linen is nice as well. So that's kind of my, a quick rundown of, you know, kind of a basic, painting method. A lot of times, you know, after I've got that initial block in, I've got my darks established, I'm doing my lights. Once I kind of get those two extremes, the lightest lights and the darkest darks, yep, then I'll go in and I'll kind of pretty much start at the top of the painting and just kind of work my way down, finishing as I go. And theoretically, once I get to the bottom, you know, I'm done. But most of the time I'll go back in and I'll tweak areas here and there. I might do some glazing, so I'll let those layers dry. I'll do some glazing over the top to, you know, maybe push it warmer, cooler, give it an aged look, whatever I'm wanting to do. Glazing is certainly a, it's not something I do on every painting, but I do it on quite a few. So,
yeah. Now that's awesome. I was going to ask you your surface, and yeah, I appreciate that. So it's a gator board. Is that have like a foam core? What's that like?
It is. It's foam core. It's got, you know, it's real rigid. I don't know if you've ever painted on gator board or experienced what gator board. It's like it's a foam core, but it's very rigid. I mean, it's, you can break it if you bend it. It'll snap, you know, as opposed to just kind of, you know, just kind of creasing. It'll actually just snap apart. It's kind of fragile in that regard. I'm not, it's a little bit of a concern that, you know, these surfaces are a little fragile, but I mean, you'd really have to, you know, I don't know, stick up whatever. Yeah, I mean, you could stick a fist through it, I suppose, if you wanted to. But I mean, you got to be kind of careful with the knife, but not really, because I don't know. It's not a paper that the outside layer is. It's I don't know what it is, to be honest with you, but it's very, very tough. You know,
yeah.
It takes the paint really well, and then when I'm making little panels to paint on, like sometimes what I'll do is I've got a heat press, like a vacuum table that you put the gator board in and you sandwich this layer of, it's like a glue film, and then you put the linen on top of that. It goes in this heat press, and so it heats that glue film, and then it has a vacuum too that sucks the board up and sandwiches them together and makes a really nice, you know, product. It's essentially what frame shops use for mounting photos or whatever to the substrate, you know, like a gator board or some other kind of foam core. So what I'll do is I'll just make big sheets of that stuff, and then I'll just cut it up into whatever size panels, small panels that I want to do. If I'm working on anything above a 32 by 40, I will use stretch canvas, because that's 32-40 is the biggest size that I typically get the gator board in. You can get it bigger, but it really spendy. So I typically, if I'm going bigger than 32-40, I typically will stretch my own canvas or linen at that point. But I like it. I like the gator board too, because it's very light. It's not heavy like a Masonite.
Right.
It's extremely light. And again, I said it's rigid. It's very rigid. It just, for working with the knife, it just takes the paint really well. because, you know, there's no balance, there's no give, which like a stretch linen, which I, that's not a bad thing. I can get used to that too. I'm just used to having a rigid support to paint on. I like that better. And I like the ability to be able to scrape it off if I need to.
So, yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That's so helpful. And I think, you know, when you get into those bigger sizes, weight does become a factor. And so, you know, I it makes a lot of sense that you would use a, that Gator board. I've used it a little bit. But I think for our listeners, it's important for them to hear what that is. And, but yeah, there is some challenges there with some of the, you know, you don't want to take a hammer to it. That's for sure.
No, and you got to be careful. Like if you're, you know, if you drop one side on the ground, you could chip a corner off, you know, I mean, can happen too with Masonite, you know, I mean, that's kind of the nature of the beast. I suppose a birch plywood would be a better solution. It's a little tougher probably, but
yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I've just, really enjoy using that Mason or the Gator board. I like it a lot.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. And thanks for your process and your tools. You know, I think a lot of people, when they see what us artists end up actually using for our tools, it's like, oh, that's all, you know, like a couple of those big industrial brushes, you know, it's like, you don't really need anything too fancy. You know, if it gets the job done, it gets the job done.
That's exactly right.
It's inspirational. You know, you don't need to break the bank to get everything you need to get started.
No, I will say, however, that these are my most expensive items right here because I used to use a cheap, palette knives that you would buy that have a little weld right here, you know, and I would snap them off. They would break. And I would break two or three of those knives a year. And I'm like, what is going on? So eventually I invested in these knives, which are made by Holbein or Holbein. I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but they're phenomenal. And yeah, they're pricey. You know, they're going to run you maybe $50 for this guy. And I don't know, $35, $40, but I've had them for years. I've never broken one. I will, as I use them though, I will tend to kind of wear a kind of a concave edge. Because I paint on a glass palette, and I'm constantly scraping, you know. Number one, it gets them razor sharp. You got to be very careful as you're using them because, I mean, I've cut myself. But it also kind of wears that kind of concavity. And then as I'm going to put the paint on, it just doesn't lay out nice. So I'm constantly, not constantly, but occasionally, a few times a year, I will have to grind that edge down and get a straighter edge. So I just take it out to my whetstone, you know, and so... This knife used to be bigger. The tip was probably that much bigger and it was probably wider. So it's getting smaller. Pretty soon it'll be the size of this guy, but it'll be a few more years. But I would say if you're going to try palette knife painting, eventually you're going to want to invest in a really quality knife. I think Liquitex makes some really good knives too. I saw somebody on Facebook say they make a really good knife that also does not have a weld. These were supposedly made by, Ninja or samurai sword makers in Japan or something. It's Japanese steel. It's really good stuff, but
wow.
You know, but even that, you don't have to go out and buy one of these to produce a nice painting. And yeah, I think for years I thought, oh, that's what that artist is using. That's them, whatever, the $150 Kolinsky sable. I got to get that. And then I'll propel myself to the next level of, you know, artistry. Now you don't need that. I mean, you do need quality, in the sense that, I mean, some of these guys, they shed a lot of bristles. Like I'll spend a half an hour just picking the bristles out of my priming and then off the painting. And that's annoying, but overall, it's, you know, they hold up well enough. And then when they're done, I just go buy another one. They're cheap, you know? So,
yeah.
I mean, I think we didn't talk about what kind of paint I use. We talked about the colors, but I'm not really a brand loyal guy. There's one color that I've only been able to find it in this, and it's the Rembrandt Transoxide Brown. And
okay.
I've tried other brands and I don't like they don't have the same intensity. They don't have the same transparency. So I always go back to Rembrandt in that color. Okay. Because for me, and you, I think you must use a lot of that in your work too, because you have those beautiful, rich, you know, dark reddish brown tones. But I don't know if that's what you use or not, but I love this color, and it makes beautiful, rich darks when you mix it with your ultramarine blue or some your viridian or phthalo green or something like that.
Yeah.
You still get, you get a nice transparency to your darks. So I love that color. But you know, I kind of buy what's on sale as far as paint.
Yeah. What's the other brands that you're typically using?
I use Gamlin quite a bit. Sometimes I just use like a Dick Blick, you know, their professional grade. Again, I kind of try to buy what's on sale. I've run the gamut, you know, Winsor & Newton and you name it. I mean, Old Holland, I use a lot. I mean, but, Richeson, Holbein, I've got a smattering of all different brands up here on my palette right now. But, again, it's kind of what's on sale. What do I need? I usually buy, you know, on these bigger tubes just because, you know, like I'll go through a crap load of this, you know, just titanium white. And
right.
This is just a Gamblin. I think it's, I don't want to say this is their cheap student grade stuff because I don't want to tell people I'm using student grade, but I think it's a cheaper grade. It's their 1980. It works fine, you know, for some of the earth tones. And if I'm getting more into the cadmiums and that sort of thing, that's where I will spend the money. So I try to stay away from the hues and that sort of thing. I want a little bit more heavily pigmented paint.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes if you're going with hues and that sort of thing, it's diluted down. So you got to use a lot more of it because it just doesn't have the tinting power.
Yep.
But there's a lot of like earth tones and stuff you can get by with some cheaper paint, in my opinion. I mean, that's a touchy subject with a lot of artists. They're like, oh no, you can't use that. You got, you know, so I don't know, to each his own. I feel like if it mixes the colors that I want to mix, then I'm pretty happy with it.
Yeah. So, you know, it's really, what's the word? It's refreshing to hear where you're at with that. Cause I felt very much the same that I've tried a lot of, you know, kind of a gamut of different brands and things like that. And there's some where, you know, they just don't have like the really strong pigment qualities and you just like, yep, that one's not good. I won't get that again.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've got three or four brands that I kind of go in between and mix and match. And it's not that big a deal. And I think most importantly, you want to make sure that you've got light fastness and that permanence of color is the biggest thing, that it's going to last over time, you know? But besides that, whatever works.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's been a couple of colors, that I've eliminated from my palette just because of that light fastness issue. I mean, I don't know that I'm probably not going to see much degradation within my lifetime, but you know, maybe in future generations might. So like some of the stuff, I guess alizarin, straight up alizarin is supposedly not that light fast. I mean, I guess there's an alizarin permanent that is better. But yeah, that's, you definitely want to be mindful of that. You know, some of the yellowing of colors, some of the, you know, like some of the whites and that sort of thing. If you're, I don't know, I feel like titanium white is probably going to be pretty good. I don't know that it yellows much over time. But I'm not a scientist when it comes to that sort of thing. There's a lot of artists that really delve deep into the science of paints and pigments and all that kind of stuff and can really, you know, talk scientifically about it. Me, I kind of just buy what works and, stick with it. So
yeah,
that's it, man.
No, that's awesome. Hey, thanks so much, Brent. I really appreciate you coming on here. And I think that this conversation that we've had has been extremely valuable to a lot of people, and I'm hoping that they've been taking notes. And if somebody, you know, is looking for you, like do you teach workshops? Do you, like, what's the best way to find your work? All that kind of stuff.
Oh, thanks. So workshops I don't really do currently. It's something that I'm considering doing. I don't feel very confident as a teacher. I've done a few classes. And I still do one every year, but it's at a lodge here, not too far from my house. It's called Triple Creek Lodge.
Yeah.
this workshop is designed for collectors predominantly. There are some aspiring artists that do come, but it's a high-end lodge. It's mainly to kind of give the collector an opportunity to, or a taste of what entails creating a piece of art, so that they can go home, maybe appreciate their collection of art a little bit better. It's fun. Most of them are rank beginners. They've never picked up a paintbrush up, or if they did, they were kids when they did it, you know? So it's a challenging workshop because I'm essentially, man, I got to tell them how to even put paint on the brush and how to mix, you know, anything. And so it's exhausting. By the end of those 3 days, I'm just mentally exhausted, man. But it's fun at the same time. And they go home with a nice piece, which I paint most of the painting for them. But, you know, they can go home and talk about it with their friends and all that thing. So that's fun. I do get a lot of inquiries from artists about teaching. And it's very flattering. And I'm very humbled that they would want to learn, you know, my bad habits. I don't feel like I would be a great teacher. People tell me that I'm wrong about that, but I just don't have the teaching experience. But, you know, down the road, I might want to do that. I see my battery's about to die, so I might lose you. It's something that I'm kicking around the idea of. Currently, I don't. And then as far as where can they find me, my website, cottonfinearts.com. You can find me on Instagram, just Cotton Brent, and Facebook too. So
awesome.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks again, Brent, and I really appreciate you being here, and all the best. We'll hopefully be talking again soon.
Thanks, sir. It's been a pleasure, and best of luck with your work and your podcast, and I look forward to seeing what comes out.
Okay. We'll see
you. Take care, everybody.
Yep.
Happy painting.
Thank you so much for listening to the Business of Art podcast. We would love to have you join us every week as we interview incredible artists and gain insights from their personal journeys to success. If this has been valuable to you, please subscribe and share it with your other artist friends. We'll see you in the next episode.